Chumba.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And a very good day to you. The final day of June, the final day of the second quarter of 2026, the beginning of the adventure for the second half of the year, including, of course, the American election and November 3rd, and all of this summary of the conflict in the Gulf, the conflict in Ukraine, the conflict in the South China Sea, and those are just three of the major concerns of the U.S. There are plenty of conflicts in Africa and Eurasia. To note, Pakistan, Afghanistan, with the Taliban in between, or Ethiopian civil war, Sudan in civil war, or West Africa collapsed into jihadists versus the army versus the Russians there to guard the gold mines that the Chinese are exploiting. Any manner of conflict in West Africa. East Africa is dominated by Somalia in conflict with the rise of Al-Qaeda's Al-Shabaab. There is no end to the conflict. I begin, however, with my colleague and co-host Thaddeus McCotter of American Greatness, former member of Congress in the great state of Detroit. We're going to turn immediately to comments on the American political scene, which is ever-changing, completely fluid all the time. If I were to say it's 3 hours to election day, anything could happen. That would be as accurate as it's 126 to election day and anything could happen. Anything happens at all in American politics at any given moment, and afterwards you'd pick up the pieces and say, well, maybe that mattered. That is a very good day to you. If I said there were 3 hours to the election and anything could happen, would that be an accurate statement? Good day to you.
Good day to you too, John. The electorate seems to be in a state of flux, but I think it'd be a stretch at this point to say that Republicans will hold both the House and Senate. But things could change. The things that you've mentioned regarding the Gulf, regarding the Iran conflict, regarding some of the domestic issues, if the economy can pick up and continue to pick up. It's possible, but I don't know that all things are possible.
The politics of the moment, however, devolve on the conflict zones that are commanding the headlines. I note especially the Gulf states looking to transfer money, either withheld money or frozen money, assets to Iran, quite separate from the U.S. transferring money. And this suggests, of course, something we've been watching develop for some time, that is, the American political scene is not supreme as it once was during the Cold War. What happens here cannot necessarily influence what happens in Europe or in Asia. It usually does, and usually you can find a connection, but not always, which is why I was struck by that Bloomberg headline this morning that the Gulf is operating independently. That's fresh information for me. Do you regard that as logical, Thaddeus, for where we are, that states such as in the European Union or the Gulf Cooperation Council headed by Saudi Arabia will take initiative on their own without waiting for whether the White House approves or not?
Well, I don't know. I think to a certain extent, this kind of wish casting, especially the people that don't like this administration, I think that you're going to see states are always going to act in their own best interest, but they are going to weigh very heavily what the United States is doing, what the United States considers either to be in accordance with it or to be in conflict with it. I think we're watching the Iranians themselves do this. I think their eye is focused on the American midterms as they enter into these negotiations, and I think it's impacting on how they conduct themselves, which is, from the point of view of the administration, rather unfortunate. regarding the Gulf states, I think it's high time that they actually started to recognize some of the dangers that they're facing, starting to act in concert, but that does not necessarily put them outside of what the administration would like to see from the Gulf states. And it does not mean that there isn't some assistance or at least some tacit help from the United States to do so, or at least the concurrence of the United States to do so. So I think it's far too premature to say that it's the end of the United States' influence in the region and throughout the world.
Iran ratches up talk of controlling Hormuz before new talks. Bloomberg headline. A top Iranian official reiterated the country's determination to maintain control over maritime traffic moving through the Strait of Hormuz. I learned yesterday that the opinion is the memo of understanding was not written carefully enough so that that is not an interpretation. In other words, there's no statement in the memo of understanding that when the conflict is resolved, the Strait of Hormuz maintains its status as international waterway. The Iranians are interpreting it as theirs to control. That looks to be an obvious weakness that will hesitate. At the same time, Hormuz traffic climbs as supertankers sail into Persian Gulf. So there is no longer a fear of being attacked moment to moment, depending on what supertanker represented what state. I note that Iran did attack a ship that was going through the so-called Oman Channel, meaning not in its immediate reach, and it was attacked. And the warning was, you check with us before you go through. It would appear, Thaddeus, that Iran is maintaining the rhetoric of control. You measure that something that the administration can accept, that that's just going to be part of the deal?
Well, that would be an incredible strategic victory for Iran, wouldn't it?
Yes.
They could argue that they control the Gulf. That would make you question why we were there in the first place. So I don't think it's something that the administration can abide. I go back to what I said earlier. I think the Iranians understand American politics. They understand that come November, you could have Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate. And come in January, it's going to impair the Trump administration's ability to conduct any type of operations regarding Iran. And I think they're playing for time. I think they're trying to make sure that they have as much on the table as they possibly can, should any negotiations in the future occur. I'm not surprised by any of this. You and I have talked in many ways. These negotiations are akin to what happened to the British Empire during the negotiations during the Opium Wars in the 19th century. The Chinese Empire would do everything they can to delay things, obfuscate things, everything they could to frustrate a superior military power. It did not end as well, that well for the Chinese Empire, but the practice and the tactics remain about the same.
I propose that we begin a recording starting with the domestic politics and then moving towards the foreign affair politics. I'm just looking at headlines now. Lebanon, Israel pact fragile after Hezbollah's vow of disruption. A growing oil glut spurs Asian refiners to offer cargoes to the U.S. In other words, the usual chaos in foreign affairs. So we'll begin right away. Thaddeus, you're falling off at the end of each sentence, so watch that with your mic.
I was trying not to get the echo.
The echo is not anything profound. It's because of the bare room and the way the mic is set up. There's nothing your voice can do about it. It's just that at the end of the sentence, your mic is falling off a little bit as you conclude your remark. Here we go. We'll do the best we can. This is the making of the John Batra Show, about to become the John Batra Show itself. And we'll begin with domestic politics. I'm going to that right now. We have plenty. Call the Supreme Court. My heavens. Decisions of plenty, but mostly I'm not concerned with the intricacies of precedent or who voted for what. It's the way the Trump administration is presenting this to its base called MAGA and to the American people, the independents, and to the poll numbers that may or may not be determinative of how the administration responds to all of these conflicts in overseas and the conflicts at home. So here we begin. 5, 4, 3. This is 18 minutes for tonight, that is. 1. I'm John Batchelor. That is McCutter, my friend and co-host of many years, is here to comment American greatness on the domestic politics of the moment with more than 125 days to go till the election, 126 to be exact, November 3rd, and the foreign politics that dominate the headlines these days, but I have learned over the years are not as determinative as domestic politics. Thaddeus, a very good evening to you. When last we spoke, the price of gasoline had not moderated, and there was an unending sense that there would be more bad news from the Gulf. Since then, there have been developments pointing to a resolution. Certainly the price of gasoline, a barrel of oil, has dropped dramatically, and there is reporting super tankers moving through the Strait of Hormuz. At the same time, there's plenty of concern domestically about the price of anything in the store, the cost of living. The question of affordability always comes up in political conversation, and the Congress answers the domestic call most particularly when it's facing re-election. How do you measure the landscape right now for the Republican majority in the House of Representatives and in the Senate? The year is determined here by the Senate, but I understand, but everybody in the House is either up for re-election or has announced their retirement at this point. The news reporting always emphasizes the very thin margin that Republicans have to give up, and mention the history of a party not in the White House losing seats in the first midterm. Do you see anything irregular about this election? Will it follow historical examples? Good day to you.
Good day to you, John. It's a very perilous time for Republicans based upon the international situation and, more importantly, as you mentioned, the domestic situation. I thought it was very cagey of the Democrats to switch the word inflation for affordability. Inflation could be pinned on the Biden administration, past Democratic Congresses, by going towards affordability. That seems to be uniquely a Trumpian problem at this point. It seems to obfuscate the prior damage that was done by the Democrats and their excessive, insane spending and policies. Regardless, right now it is a Republican majority, a very slim one, and you have a president of the United States who now seems to be focusing again on the midterms, understanding what could be at stake. Interestingly, though, we've seen the president, he's done two things, and they're kind of at cross purposes, John. One is he's become very involved in some of these primaries. We've seen that happen in Michigan. We've seen that obviously happen in places like Texas. And in response to the Democratic Socialist mayor of New York, the president pointed out that his record in primaries is undefeated, apparently. That may or may not be the case, but regardless, he's trying to rack up victories to strengthen his hand come the midterms, to hold that over people who may seek higher office or other offices in the final 2 years of his term, use that as a cudgel against them. The problem is the secondary aspect of that is a primary is one thing, and he seems to be trying to get as many of MAGA or Trump-friendly people in positions within the party for nominations, but you have a general election. So what I think is more important is not how many people he gets through a primary, but how many people gets through a general election. And that goes to the point of what you talked about. Is the party stronger for the people that came out of these primaries, or is it going to be weaker heading into the general election? And the general consensus is some places are decidedly weaker, such as Texas, heading into the general election for the Senate race than they would have been with the current incumbent Republican.
The Senate is a special place, so I want to start in the House. The House retirements are racking up, but that happens every year. The sense is that the House is not moving legislation or not initiating legislation. It's just a sense that's given out. The president wants everything to devolve to the success for his, I think it's called the SAVE Act. It has to do with national voting as early as the midterm. And repeatedly, the White House emphasizes, pass the SAVE Act, pass the SAVE Act. The results from the Supreme Court yesterday, which did not endorse the idea of banning or removing mail-ins in certain states. All of that led the president to say, the solution to all these difficulties is to pass the SAVE Act. Does the SAVE Act touch the American pocketbook? Because I have learned repeatedly, if you're a pocketbook issue, you're going to dominate the midterms.
I would think that you would be focusing on domestic concerns, especially areas, quote unquote, of affordability, end quote, that will provide relief and reassurance to the American voter that things, better things are on the horizon, especially when you look at some of the concerns people have regarding the state of the economy and its prospects for the future. So you could make the argument that by focusing on the SAVE Act, the president is making the point that it's everything that's in place now, the dynamics of the economy are in place heading into the midterm. There's not much you can do about it. And instead, we have to make sure that you have qualified voter rolls with actual Americans voting on them and so forth. So you've gone past some of the substantive policies that will go into the election regarding the economy, and you're focusing more on the political end of it. And we saw this with Democrats who are granted or out of power. We saw them with some of the redistricting decisions, and the Republicans came in with their own redistricting decisions. And I just would like to add this, John, because as we head into this midterm, it's very important. Changing the congressional lines, be it done by Republicans or by Democrats, shorter than every 10 years, makes it harder for people to know who represents them. It makes it harder for people to want to engage in the process outside the partisans. And it does incredible damage to the fabric of civic participation, electoral participation in the country. That's why they were held at once every 10 years when you would redistrict. You would get acquainted with who represents you, good or bad. You could vote them out. You could actively participate. You could plan to unseat them. You could plan to support them over the course of the decade. Now it's much harder for people to do that. And it just shows that the extremes in both parties are having their sway and leaving the middle ground of the voters alienated.
Do the American people like a divided Congress, that is? Is that something they're more comfortable with than one side or the other?
It depends on the circumstances. If you have a president that you like very much, you generally will tend to support members of their party to give them the ability to put forward an agenda that you like. A lot of times, if you don't like the president or you want to put a check on the president, the checks and balances, not being a quaint idea, but being obviously something that we still continue to practice every day, you will elect the opposite party to Congress to hold that president to account. And that's what the Democrats are hoping will happen. And it seems to be probable at this point come the midterm.
I note that the Democrats are concerned with some of their more outspoken voices. I'm thinking of the Democratic Socialists of America. I think it's called DSA.
Right. Yeah.
They're young and they're colorful and they're beyond progressive, the way it's presented. It sounds to my senior ears that we're dealing with the left side of the equation having its own version of MAGA.
We've talked about this, John. This is the Democratic Civil War that was going on. Bernie Sanders was one of the great pioneers of this. And it is their version, is their side of the coin of the MAGA Republican establishment battle. You saw James Carville, a Clinton era pundit, very, very well respected in political circles, talking about how the DSA, that there could be a Democratic schism. And their policies are very far left. Again, they're socialists, and I would argue that many of them are communists as well. But they get elected. They get elected in some of the blue cities. So this is a problem for the Democratic Party. And I think the Democratic Party at this point in time, the more moderate and the more sane that they appear, the more chances they have picking up seats. The last thing they need is to have people that run around saying, eliminate penitentiaries, defund the police, complete control of rental properties, free this, free that. It makes them look radical. It makes them look extreme. It takes away from all the messaging they've done to paint MAGA and the President Trump as President Trump as extreme. So this is like the worst thing that could happen to them. And welcome to the club. Civil war in your own party. Been there doing that, I suppose.
And on the MAGA side, I interpret nothing. I just read the trends in the headlines, reading all the reporters. And the MAGA looks not only a division within the Republican Party, but a division within MAGA. I think we mentioned last time that TV personality Tucker Carlson is making remarks splitting away from his president. I believe there are others, outspoken voices on the radio or on the internet, who describe themselves as MAGA or were once described as MAGA, are going in a different direction. Is this the natural evolution of the party, Thaddeus, and nothing unusual, a break for younger individuals to define themselves as a senior president is about, well, he's a lame duck. There are two more years.
I don't measure the Republican Party by pundits. I mean, you have pundits that were very much pro-Trump when President Trump would say nice things about them and grant them access. And when that stopped, they became anti-Trump. And then they had to look for their clickbait elsewhere. So I do not measure many things by pundits at all, except the fact that they're out there to run their own little shtick. Unlike some shows that provide information so that people can make up their own minds, that's not the business that they're in. And so they're going to do whatever they can to keep their careers going. And I think that's the country takes second place to that.
There's a scene in the new book, Regime Change, which I've read now. It reads very easily. It's written by two New York Times reporters, and it is the first year of the Trump administration from the transition of 24 to 25 all the way to the last item is March of 26. And the scene is in the Situation Room in the basement of the White House, meeting between the FBI, the Department of Justice, the White House, Chief of Staff, and representatives, and other concerned parties to do with the Epstein scandal. And one of the players at the table speaking is a man named Bongino, who has a radio and podcast, I believe, and walked away from that to become a senior figure at the FBI. I think he's former Secret Service. And his presentation, especially directed against the Attorney General, was over the top. Let's put it this way: irregular, rude, and aggressive about how much money he'd given up to serve in the administration. He named a number, $44 million. I don't know whether it's accurate or not, and that it was important to the people who listened to him that the Epstein matter be transparent and aired and no hiding. I think the man Blanche, who is now the acting attorney general, was also in the room. What struck me about it was that the Trump administration has within it the division itself. In other words, it's not outside the White House, it's inside the White House, making accusations against each other. Now, you've been involved in several administrations, and you've observed them from the outside and inside. Is that the logic of the White House, that you're always going to have the divisions in the party are going to show up here in the Situation Room?
Well, the Trump administration has done a lot of things with pundits and placed them in the administration with people that he's seen on Fox News or other places. So there's nothing new there. Bongino, I think he's left the administration, so he's gone back to his money. So he's doing all right.
Well, Kane, the chairman of the Chiefs of Staff, Kane, I believe he was a television personality. So it's consistent with how Mr. Trump stocks his decisions on the basis of the media.
The Secretary of War, using that term, but the knee Secretary of Defense came out of Fox News as well. Look, all administrations have divisions. All administrations leak. They leak on each other. They leak everywhere else. I mean, remember Donald Reagan and Nancy Reagan?
Yes.
All that kerfuffle.
Yes.
There's nothing new here with that. I like to go to used book sales, John, and I find all these current political, historical books about year one of the Trump administration or year three of the Obama administration. There's like tons of them. All these political books, just stacks and stacks of books that are no longer relevant and nobody cares about. Meanwhile, people like me are busy reading about Hoover Dam and how that was created. You know, so some things to stand the test of time, like Hoover Dam, even if books about the Hoover administration don't necessarily do so.
That is McCotter, American Greatness, former member of Congress. We're going to turn to foreign affairs momentarily to see if that is a weight that the administration can bear through the election in November. I'm John Batchelor with my colleague Thaddeus McCotter of American Greatness, former member of Congress representing the great state of Michigan in the House of Representatives. We come to the foreign affairs matters at the moment, at the end of the second quarter, beginning the second half of the year within hours, and the election, the midterm election in on November 3rd. The headlines are promising domestically because the economy is not broken and the gas lines are not apparent, and the price of gasoline is moderating for the holiday weekend, which everybody, I think, started last Saturday for the holiday. So I come to the headlines that concern again and again what is going on in the Gulf. According to Bloomberg, Iran is now claiming the Strait of Hormuz as its responsibility and tool. That is not evident from other remarks, but according to Bloomberg, the Gulf states are starting to open relations with Iran quite separate from the U.S. According to the Financial Times, we're looking at more and more investments being made on the fact that the Iranian oil is going to enter in back into the market. And there's no reason to fear $126 a barrel. We're headed more towards in the 60s. There's, in fact, the word glut being used internationally. I concentrate on that, Thaddeus. There are other matters I could talk about, war fighting. But the price of a barrel of oil, at least for the last 3 months, has come to represent the American economy. Is that now something that we can put aside? That was then, this is now, and the American people will not obsess about the price of gasoline at the pump?
I was out yesterday with a friend. He's very conservative. He's a Trump supporter. And he was expressing his concern about these whole 60 days things. I think the quote was, "I'm very tired of these 60-day announcements. I just want to see something get done and see the price of gas come down." I think that when you're hearing that in your own base, you run the risk in international affairs of this administration signing on to just about anything to get out from underneath the weight of high gas prices as we head into the midterm. I think that we have to remember that money's fungible, that a lot of decisions that are made in the next couple of weeks, perhaps maybe even the next 60 days, if not longer, are going to have long-term ramifications, not only for the region, but here in the United States. I mean, we're dealing with the number one exporter of terrorism in the world. We're seeing them trying to claim that they have control of the Straits of Hormuz or have a significant interest in what is, by all rights, the international waterway. Their interference should be rejected. You're going to see them have relief on some of the sanctions, and they're all going to do this. And when the money comes pouring in, they're going to start diverting it to their proxies, to diverting to the exportation of terrorism. They'll probably go back into reconstituting their nuclear program at some point. And they're doing this and putting everything on the table because they know that the administration is heading into midterms and is going to try to do everything they can to strengthen its own hand here at home, heading into the polls, heading into the ballot booths, than it is necessarily concerned about making sure that there is a long-term productive agreement with the Iranians or with hopefully a different regime, but to make sure the United States and its strategic interests and those of our partners and allies are protected. Right now, that hangs in the balance, and there is a great concern that those things may be shunted aside for the immediate short-term gain of trying to, again, strengthen your hand heading into the midterms.
Can we choose between affordability and the price of a gallon of gasoline, or are they both equally going to be used in the campaign?
Well, the price of energy as a whole goes into everything. It can affect everything. The price of the way I responded to my friend was, yes, it's a shame, because right now it looks as if we're all going to have to carpool when we go up to our friend's cabin.
Right.
And so all foreign policy, it all becomes domestic to a certain extent. All politics will remain local in how international international conflict will impact domestic affairs is something people will vote on. They won't necessarily vote on the international affair itself, but they will vote based upon its consequences here at home.
That is McCarter, American Greatness. I'm John Batchelor. Thank you, Thaddeus. I just racked that up. It went a little long, but I can handle it. Where's my note?
That wasn't dropping off at the end, was it?
Your voice drops down at the end of every sentence, which is why I asked you to, because of the way the mic is. You start out stronger on the mic, and then you end not as strong. That's why you bite it off at the end. It's the room bounce up behind you that takes up the noise.
Or I could be losing interest in what I'm talking about. I bore myself.
No, it's not boredom. It's too consistent. We have to compensate for it. We have a special guest, Thaddeus.
Wonderful.
A very special guest from Taipei, Taiwan. My dear friend Ann, very carefully, Ann Stevenson Yang, has been living in Taiwan for some months now, and I've not spoken to her for a little bit. We speak regularly to report on the Chinese economy. I introduce Ann as someone who traveled China from the before the miracle, during the miracle, and after the miracle of the Chinese economy. And I welcome her for the first time to StreamYard's live streaming of the making of the John Batchelor Show. Anne, a very good evening to you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, John. Long time no talk. And Thaddeus, very nice to see you. I wasn't bored at all with your comments. I was listening.
Yes, Thaddeus, you now have you have to deal with the fact that Taipei listened in on your remarks, okay? I've asked Anne specially here because of the serendipity she was kind enough to acknowledge. This is the author of Wild Ride, a book I highly recommend for those of you who think, I don't understand China. Anne's book explains China. The opening scene of Anne being ushered into onto a stage and the curtain opens. And in front of her, and the way I picture it, I know it's not exactly the way you wrote it, but it's the way I picture it, a room full of engineers and entrepreneurs of the future, probably half of them now billionaires, all sitting there dressed exactly alike with happy smiles on their faces, waiting for the United States of America to show up and tell us how to make money. The curtain opens and there's Anne standing looking at the audience. What were your thoughts, Anne? What is that, 1992, 93? It was very early. What were your thoughts when that curtain opened?
Yeah, like I was expecting to just go sit in the audience. I didn't. And then they usher me into the back because, you know, I was staying right across the street. They sent a car for me, but I'm like, why would I take a car? I'm right across the street. So I walk over. They usher me up in the back stairs. I can't see anything. I push aside this big velvet curtain, and then this like sodium light strobe goes on me, and everybody's like, ah, and I'm like, oh my God, 300 people and I have to speak Chinese.
And they wanted to know what the secret is, and you must have told them, because do you remember the year? Is it 92?
It was 93. It was the spring of 93.
Spring of 93. The miracle begins. Well, Thaddeus, I've asked Anne here this morning to explain an item in the Financial Times that struck me as a lifestyle item that's going to be dominant in American and Chinese novels for some time. It's about the ghost cities. The magic of the ghost cities, Anne, I can't get away from it. By ghost city, that's a definition that came up several years ago. Anne was reporting on them. Those are the developments in the secondary and tertiary cities that we're expecting, if we build it, they will come. So they build housing for thousands, tens of thousands of people, and then they would build imitation sets, pieces from their reading of America and Europe. And a Versailles Palace would be one feature, or the whole of Wall Street reproduced in buildings so that you could feel like you were in Wall Street, Asia. Those are the two extreme examples I can remember, but I think again and again they were using themes like the London Bridge in order to attract the investor class and or people to live there. Well, it didn't happen, and those buildings are still there, and I picture them often with the rain blowing through the windows. I think at some point there have been descriptions of people living there on the second floor, and they're heating their water with open fires. I don't want to get carried away from it, because the item this morning is why I asked Dan to join us to comment on the young Chinese choosing life in ghost cities, writes the Financial Times. Urban castaways are making homes in half-empty towers left over from the world's biggest housing boom. That was enough for me to send it to Anne saying, exactly as you designed it, but they're way ahead of the schedule. They're living in an unfinished building. And then, Anne, you provided a detail. I couldn't ignore it. We all know Madame Butterfly. We understand the way it ends with Butterfly is dead and her prince, the tenor, is calling out Butterfly, Butterfly, Butterfly. And this is a fact that means that they've got a housing development of butterflies. Please explain to the audience what you've heard about these half-empty cities, Anne.
Yeah, except I don't think they'll be hanging themselves. That's a bit much. So I was just telling John about this city built by the developer Evergrande in Yunnan province quite a while ago. It was built for 60,000 people. It had a 5-star hotel that was advertised on C-Trip, but when I went in there, it was actually pigeons flying around, and there wasn't any hotel open. It had a movie theater, which also wasn't open. It had a supermarket, da da da. But the whole place had been taken over and used as an Arnai village, and Arnai is the number one mistress of a Chinese businessman or government official. And of course, you don't want to keep them, you know, near your wife. So this was dedicated as a village for these mistresses, and pretty nice too, because, you know, there was maybe 1/6 occupancy. That's what they claimed. So probably even less. So it was really calm and quiet and pretty. It was a little bit remote, but, you know, if your living is to be in Arnai, then, you know, it was fun.
I want to make sure I understand this. The whole ghost city was given over to this one building or series of buildings that were like islands of serenity, and in that were the mistresses of the well-to-do businessmen who were in the big cities, and they would travel to here and visit. Is that how to describe
this? That's correct. So you have a place, you know, relatively inexpensive, but pretty place to put your girlfriend, and you put her up there. Several of them had babies, and you know, their male friends would visit them on weekends, and they would just stay there. So that was a, you know, that was a reasonable economic value for this Evergrande development. But, you know, it had been built for 60,000 people, and there were at most 10,000.
Wow. I mean, that is my immediate reaction is, do we make this a novel and then an opera, or go straight to the opera? My heavens.
I'm not sure it's quite as tragic as Butterfly, but, you know, there was a city built in the middle of the desert in Inner Mongolia, in the middle of the Gobi Desert, and nobody wanted to live there, so they had to cut off the bus line that ran there so that people would have to live there because they had jobs there. The government moved there, and I went to an apartment that was occupied by 4 teenage boys. And they were thrilled, of course, because they got to live 50 kilometers away from their parents. Why did they live there? Because in an effort to fill up the local school, the county government had exploded the junior high in the main part of the main district in Ordos. So they had no school to go to except this one. So they moved into this empty apartment and they cooked on a Bunsen burner. And they were so happy.
These are boys living on their own, sort of?
Yeah, they were like 14 years old, something like that. And they were living on their own, except, you know, they'd go home on weekends.
I think it's called Lord of the Flies. Lord of the Flies. Thaddeus, you have a question about the ghost cities?
Well, there had to be some economic incentive to do this. There has to be some motive for this, wasn't there? Or was this just to build it up and increase the numbers of construction in the country overall to show that China was growing? I mean, how does this happen?
No, of course there was motive to build them, but the people who were building them were local governments. And local governments had every incentive to create construction jobs, to create... And the big incentive is that if you increase the density of your area, so basically you'd have an area, let's say it's 10 square kilometers, and you tell everybody, hey, I'm going to buy your land for $10,000. And it's like, wow, I've never seen that much income before. And you move all those people to 1 square kilometer. So now you have 1 square kilometer that has much higher density. You get to reclassify the area as urban, which has huge benefits both for the officials and the people. So it's a win-win.
We have to tell everybody. Let us begin. I'll start from the top of the article and we won't get to the mistresses right away, if we get there at all, because, I mean, really, the opera, I can hear them scratching the music right now. Good heavens. You know, and it occurs to me every once in a while when I run up against Chinese culture that it's not just that it's old, it's that it's sentimental, just as American culture is. We have a great deal in common because we both go for the same kind of story. Madame Butterfly. Anything tragic love affair. Good heavens. There's nothing necessarily dire about this. It's just that immediately I thought, well, all right, I can hear the music. Here we go. 5. Thank you, Anne. 4.
Thank you.
3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. Thaddeus McCotter, my colleague and co-host, continues with me from the great state of Michigan. And we go immediately to Taipei, Taiwan. Anne Stephenson Yang, author of most recently The Wild Ride, the story of Anne's presentation to the Chinese people before the miracle took hold in the late 20th century, during the miracle sweeping over all the world, the investors, the manufacturers, the housing, certainly the development of the Chinese military and its presence in East Asia. All that is taken into account in Wild Ride, but here we are 10, 20 years later, and the Wild Ride has calmed down to what you'd have to say set pieces that are half tragic and half farce. For example, in the Financial Times in these last hours, an item that is presented with this headline, "The Young Chinese Choosing Life in Ghost Cities. Urban castaways are making homes in half-empty towers left over from the world's biggest housing boom." And there's a photograph accompanying the Financial Times piece of what appeared to be a high rise of many apartments, but there are only 2 lights on, far apart on one upper floor. Nothing else going on in the whole building, which illustrates a generality that major investment and major building firms have collapsed over these last years. So that it is not an exaggeration to describe housing in China as a crater. And a very good evening to you. This ghost city attention that the Financial Times is giving, what you have for years illustrated vividly about building cities they were hoping people would come, municipalities borrowing against their future, now in deep in debt, so that it's not just a crater of real estate, it's the inability of the municipalities to have confidence they can pay their teachers and firemen and mayors. You illustrated that and identified it all very carefully. So this present Financial Times article, I know it doesn't surprise you, but is China now recognizing that it must deal with this problem? Are they finally coming to terms with these empty buildings, or does the farce continue? Good day to you, Anne.
Hi, John. I think that people have been acknowledging this issue for quite a long time now. But the problem is that if you put it on the books and you admit, I mean, one thing that struck me from that article was the guy who said, well, the landlord bought this place for 1 million renminbi and now you couldn't get 500,000 for it. That's a 50% drop, which is way more than the government has reported. And that's not surprising because if you report the real figures, which everybody says are around 50%, then the banks are in big trouble.
Thaddeus, you have a question for Anne.
Anne, what would have led the municipalities to do this? What were the incentives behind it?
Well, it's kind of as if you know, the Chinese at the time of the global financial crisis, Chinese leaders were really, really anxious to replace export demand with domestic demand. So they went to the domestic governments and they said, "Give us all your wish list. We'll fund anything." And fund it with loans. So it's kind of like as if you went to sort of Beavis and Butthead in the middle of, you know, Wyoming, and you said, "Here's $10 million, do something to develop your town in Wyoming." So what would they do, right? Make a bong factory? You know, you're giving money into the hands of people who aren't really motivated or educated to use the money properly. There's that. There's also the set of incentives in local governments, which was to create construction jobs, to create demand for steel, to create demand for cement. And, you know, if the apartments actually sold, all the better, but they didn't really care.
The Financial Times: from their balconies, residents of prosperous Lakeside Mansion, name of the housing, can look south toward China's Daya Bay or out over Verdun Hills, around the city of 6 million near Hong Kong. But for Ruby Chen, the appeal of the high-rise towers complex lies in another feature. It is half empty. Rents are dirt cheap, and unlike China's biggest cities, this place is never overcrowded. Is this something new, Anne, that they've decided not to worry about the fact that they can't pay for anything and let's get what we can for rent and people moving in because of why? I guess because they don't mind living in a dream.
Well, I mean, if you could get a nice three-bedroom apartment for $200, then you might do that too. And so that's the calculus, particularly of people who work remotely. They figure, well, you know, if we move out to these places. And for the owners, any income is income. So sure, it's a way of, you know, it's an efficient way of dealing with this. What really would have been efficient is if the government, instead of refinancing all of these developer loans, had just given away the property to households. But, you know, that's not how governments work.
That happened during the pandemic here. I had a report one day that the man who owned or operated a hotel in Midtown Manhattan just turned the keys in and walked away. Couldn't keep up the loan, wasn't going to take the loss, just turn it back and admit the foreclosure. Is that going on in China anywhere, or has that been avoided? Just give it up.
Yeah, that happened a ton. But, you know, the U.S. has a legal system. China's legal system is very patchy. So what you'd have is you know, I talked to a guy, for example, who was a fairly large developer in Ordos in Inner Mongolia. And he was sitting in, you know, in a dark room in this tower because his company owed so much money that if he got a new loan, he'd only pay back part of the money. He'd still be in debt. So why do it? So he's basically just like sitting there and, you know, waiting for the company to go out of business.
And now this report of young people moving into these towers, is this a new phenomenon? Because I've also been told that the unemployment for the young can be as high as 35%.
Yeah, I think probably the most serious unemployment is among the rural population. The number for young people is really more about the government's concern that college graduates will rise up because they don't have work. But yeah, unemployment is a problem. I certainly have friends and family who live in these dark complexes with two or three apartments filled.
Thaddeus, you have a question?
Yes, Anne. We've seen in certain places where you, in the United States, where if you implement rent control, the landlords will just sit back and not maintain the buildings. How are these buildings maintained, given the short, the less than adequate revenue they may have to do so?
Well, it's a problem. The developers generally commit to 2 years of maintenance fees. But so they're maintained initially, and the people who used to live on the land where the development is built, they're often given jobs taking care of, you know, cleaning up the place, weeding it, running the elevators, whatever. So the local government has incentive to keep them there, but, you know, maintenance is a problem.
What has happened to those set pieces I described, the Versailles, the Wall Street Journal, the Hollywood and Vine? Have they... Have they deteriorated in the rain? Are they being maintained in some fashion?
You know, I'd like to go back and take a look. I've been to, I think I've mentioned to you, I've been to, I think, three little Hong Kongs, at least two little Manhattans, two little Parises. One of my favorites was Little Florence, which had, you know, gondolas and guys in striped shirts and hats, you know, rowing them on canals, because apparently the developer didn't realize that Florence is landlocked. He meant Venice. Anyway, so there are a ton of these replica cities, as if recreating the physical objects would give you the actual thing. So, you know, one assumes that they've that they're just sort of crumbling like Ozymandias in the desert.
And so,
sounds a lot like Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Is there
Las Vegas has actual people and throughput. Sorry, go ahead.
Is there a little Las Vegas that would be very attractive?
I've never seen one, but that is an interesting idea. Of course, gambling is not legal on the mainland, only in Macau.
Now, the item in the Financial Times doesn't extend into the revelation that you've brought to the table, that some one or more of these towers are occupied luxuriously by the mistresses of rich men from the big cities. That is something that Financial Times hasn't covered yet, but I imagine it will soon enough. Is that something that's old-fashioned with China? They printed it into the high rises, but rich men have mistresses, and everybody carries on as if they're puritanical. Is that old China as well as new China?
Yeah, there are these villages dedicated to mistresses. That's kind of an old phenomenon. It's sort of I don't know how it is now. It used to be a status symbol as a government official to have a mistress. And so even if you were gay, then you trotted somebody out to display as your mistress because you're supposed to have one.
Anne Stevenson Yang in Taipei, Taiwan, observing irony is inadequate, of the ghost cities of China as they evolve into the landscape. That is Macarthur, American Greatness. I'm John Batchelor. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you. I wanted to hear more from you, Thaddeus. I'm curious about what you think, but I guess I'll just have to listen to John's broadcast.
No, you can ask him now. We're still on air. Go ahead, ask him.
So why do you think that oil's going to come down?
Oh, I didn't say that it would. I said he's hoping that it will.
I guess you said that, John.
John said it's going to come down to maybe $60 a barrel.
$60? Yeah, why would that be?
A glut.
Why?
There is a glut right now, is the report. In other words, what we have is demand is not equal to the amount that's being pushed out. The high prices attracted people to produce oil that theretofore hadn't been profitable because of the cost of drilling and maintaining.
But I haven't heard that. So why haven't prices come down?
Well, that has to do with, depending on your conspiracy thinking, that has to do with the greed of Exxon. That would be one explanation from the federal government.
That's a very Biden-esque explanation.
Yes, well, it's being voiced.
I never believe those non-structural arguments.
I think in Michigan we're down to under $4, but it's a short term. I think what you're going to continue to see are his announcements have a short term effect. They start to lower the price, then they go back into place. And I think as we go along, you're going to continue to find out that the more influence that the Iranians have over the Straits, or the more alleged influence they have, is going to cause people to pull back and be more concerned. And that glut might turn out to be a shortage again. And it may be if people actually wise up and realize that Iran having any type of say over that strait is not going to be in anyone's best interest. That's going to impact the price of oil. But I just think everything is short term, and I think this administration's overall outlook is short term, especially when it comes to Iran. And that's problematical.
Awesome.
And I see a lot of electric guitars in the background. Do you play in a band?
No, I just put these on the wall to look cool. You know, I'm Gen X, but it's still, you know, this is to appeal to baby boomers like Bachelor.
That's right. I relaxed when Thaddeus showed me that Iron Butterfly is not without his reach. So,
yeah, Madam Iron Butterfly.
Well, I thought I'd stay with the butterfly theme. And the novel hasn't been written yet, but somebody has to write the novel of the City of Mistresses. I mean, it's just too over the top, Anne.
Oh, there are so many over the top stories there. It's just amazing.
And the indication here is everybody knows about it. Is that correct? It's not hidden from anybody.
No, it's not hidden. I think you find this in many cultures where the structure of the family is more important than the emotional content, and so everybody kind of knows what's going on, but they choose to ignore it.
And this specialty of the Chinese Communist Party, it tells me that they're old-fashioned after all. After all, the Mandarin is the Mandarin.
The Chinese culture is Chinese culture, yep. Yes.
Anne Stephenson Yang, Wild Ride, to that opening scene, and it just gets wilder from there.
She's nice to see you, John, and nice
Taiwan.
To meet you,
yes, we'll talk again
sure
soon,
you
Anne. Thank you.
Take
and
care.
Thaddeus, here comes the Roman music. And I have a robot, that drummer that the Beijing Robot Clinic sent to me to try out. I'm paying the real drummer, but this is your opinion is welcome. Here comes the robot, and thank you, Thaddeus. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show, about to go one more time to a rehearsal by the robot drummer with the Roman Orchestra.
This is Lele Pons from Suite 305 with Lele Pons. Game day at my house, it's chaos, but like in a fun way. The TV's ready, the remotes are ready, the kids' stories are going off, and somehow everybody needs batteries at the exact same time. That's why I keep Duracell stocked. And Duracell just released limited edition Duracell and Messi battery packs. The design is inspired by Messi's iconic left leg tattoo. So every battery feels like it comes with an extra kick. From the TV remote to automatic corkscrew, Duracell keeps us game day ready. Duracell double and AAA batteries are the only ones built different, with power boost ingredients for long-lasting performance you can trust. Find the limited edition Duracell and Messi batteries in stores at Lowe's and Walmart or on Amazon.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.